Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine a microphone lowered straight into the Mount Hope neighborhood of the Bronx. It misses nothing. The muttered drug deals, the slaps, the sex, the cooking, cars cruising, all the intimacy and rough edges of life where there's never enough money. Where a man who occasionally acknowledges his children and doesn't beat them is judged a good father. Where 14-year-old mothers leave their children with strung-out grandmothers to go dancing. And where the toddlers are prized for learning words like yo and ho. Well, every once in a while, a journalist takes the time and applies the determination to tell a story from a place like the Bronx. A story that simply reports, that tells you what people do. Adrian Nicole LeBlanc has written a book about one sprawling, interconnected family. She calls it Random Family. Now, Connection listeners, what do you know about empty fridges, bugs, drugs, and babies? Is bearing witness in book form enough to make the haves pay attention to those who do without? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The book, as I said, is called Random Family: Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. My guest is the writer, Adrian Nicole LeBlanc. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you for having me here.
Did you have any idea what you were getting into when you started this project, lo, these many years ago?
I absolutely did not. I thought I was writing a straightforward profile of a young man who was on trial for heroin dealing. And really, that began a journey that took about 12 years of my life.
And was there a point in the story when it became something more than just something you were reporting on, but something that you yourself were also experiencing and living?
I believe probably by the second year it became the primary organizing principle of my life. My days were structured around trying to get to the Bronx or trying to find ways to stay there for longer periods of time financially or recovering from my trips up there. But pretty quickly it became really my life.
And the characters that you chose, I want to refer to the title of the book, Random Family, because I'm curious to know whether or not that's in part what drew you to a woman called Coco, who becomes someone who you focus on, aside from all the others. Is there something about her?
Well, I had such an immediate, easy connection with Coco. I actually met her for a very practical reason, which was that the initial protagonist of the book was arrested and then sent to prison, which created a serious narrative challenge for me. And while I was trying to reconstruct her early life, I asked her to introduce me to someone who could be a guide to me in the neighborhood, and she introduced me to Coco. But we became immediately friendly. She was a very, very honest person. She would always say to me, "I'm shameless," and she was, and she really educated me about her world with a kind of spiritedness that made an otherwise very depressing, often depressing world.
How old was she when you met her first, Adrian?
When I met her, I believe she was 18.
She had how many kids at that
time? She had two children and was pregnant with her third.
Because there's a point in the book when she says she's lying on the floor of one of the apartments with Frankie, I think, who's a later companion of hers, and she says, I'm just so effing old. I'm 21 years old." And there, it was one of those moments when I went, "Oh, I thought I was reading about this person who was 35 or 40. Do you know how you drift off into thinking that they're much more grown up than they actually are?
Yes. Well, also because I think so much living is really crammed into periods of time that are also sort of interspersed with tremendously deadening periods of boredom. So there's like this sort of jam-packed action in some ways and lots of chaos, yet at the same time there's a profound sort of periods of languid sort of hanging around. I actually see a lot of parallels in the experience of these kids with police work. You know, I think there are the sort of the moments of action and then in between them, waiting.
I should say that Coco the woman we're talking about, who's one of the women in the book, has unbelievable steel. I mean, she perseveres in the face of circumstances, one or two of which would stop us cold, and she has six or seven, which she keeps going. And I say that in advance of a part of the book that I'd like you to read from, because it's not particularly flattering to Coco, and we can talk a bit about
sure.
that. But this is a passage which I recall is one that just forces you face first into, you know, one of those moments of high stress. Do you want to say anything about it before you read it, just that moment, or are you better off just to
One thing I would just like to say in terms of the reporting of it is I remember after I'd written it, you know, by the time I reported on the scene, I often wondered if things were sort of worth reporting on in a way. I'd become so familiarized with the environment that I ceased to be able to determine what I needed to take notes on sometimes. And I'm very glad that the scene ended up surviving. It just, there were lots of downtimes, and this was just a moment where she lost her temper with her children.
All right, this is Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc reading from her new book, Random Family.
One hot, sticky evening, Coco's rage exploded over everyone. Coco chased Mercedes, yelled at Nikki, and warned Nautica, "You're next." Smacks punctuated every syllable. You smack, bin smack, ask smack, ing smack, for smack, it smack, all day. Mercedes screamed, "I want my daddy." Her sisters watched her blankly. Nikki looked dazed. Coco checked her answering machine, cranking the volume to drown the girls crying. The first message was from her caseworker, who was trying to process her Section 8 application so Coco could leave Corliss Park. Coco wanted to move to a place where Frankie wouldn't have to hide like a fugitive. Frankie's voice followed. "Yo, my, yo, I've been calling you all day, yo, but you ain't there. I'll see you." She rewound the tape to hear his voice again, then dragged herself into the kitchen where the girls had gone in search of food. Mercedes scanned the refrigerator. Beside a dozen eggs, it was nearly empty. She held a bottle of sour milk at arm's length. It had spoiled while they were in the Bronx. Mercedes clipped her nose. "Mommy, it stinks. Toss it, Mercedes," Coco said wearily. "Mommy," Mercedes said helplessly. Coco snatched it and flung the full container into a corner generally designated for trash. She sent Mercedes to the store for milk. Nikki wanted cereal. Pearl wanted instant potatoes. Mercedes wanted Spam and scrambled eggs. Nautica needed to know the whereabouts of baby Matthew, her pet rock. Nikki requested the plastic bowl with the straw attached. Coco opened and shut a cabinet, and a Barbie leg caught Nautica's eye. Mercedes rescued Barbie. Nautica had by then spotted Nikki's miniature box of Fruit Loops. Coco offered cornflakes. Nautica slumped inconsolably to the floor. Nikki tiptoed by, carefully balancing the cereal bowl she'd topped to the rim with milk. Coco propped Pearl against a wall and placed a bowl of instant potatoes between her feet. "I want potatoes," Nautica said. Coco cooked a second batch. She cracked open the last of Mercedes's eggs. Mercedes changed her order to tuna fish. "Eggs and Spam ham, Mercedes." Mercedes flung herself onto the couch. "I want Spam ham," Nautica started. "Naughty," Coco sighed. She wiped the knife on her leg and sliced her a hunk and gave Pearl another dollop of potatoes, since most of the previous serving now frosted the floor. Nikki pointed to the smear. "Mommy, look." "You don't think I see," Coco replied. "I need a spoon," Nikki added. "Go find one then," Coco said. Nikki found a dirty spoon. She found baby Matthew, too. "Nautica, look," Nikki declared. "Gimme that," Coco said, grabbing the spoon from her daughter to rinse. "I don't need a spoon, Mommy," Nikki said reassuringly, slurping the milk from her bowl to demonstrate. Nautica dropped the hunk of Spam to pick up baby Matthew and happily sauntered off. Coco scooped up the potatoes and Spam and dumped them in the garbage. She stepped onto the reeking bag to stuff in the overflow and dragged it outside. The girls dropped the dirty dishes in the sink. Coco arranged the comforters on the floor and told the girls to lie down. "I can sleep here?" Mercedes asked, full of hope. "What I say, Mercedes," Coco said. Pearl scooted to the edge of the blanket and rested her cheek on the floor. The linoleum was pleasingly cool. Nautica escorted her rock through the forest of sisters, balancing baby Matthew precariously above Pearl's head. Naughty, Coco warned as she rewound the answering machine. She listened again to Frankie with a grim face, her hand on her hip, and rewound it once more. She searched the cartoon channel. Nikki snored, her sinus trouble. Mercedes propped herself against the couch. As the night wore on, she struggled to stay awake. She would doze and slip to the side, then jerk back up. Coco, gazing glassy-eyed at the familiar cartoon stories, eventually fell asleep. Only then did Mercedes allow herself to drift off.
That's Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc reading from her book, Random Family. And part of the way through that description, which, as you say, is so mundane but so well drawn, I'm wondering where you are in all this. Do you know what I mean? It's almost as if you've disappeared from the scene, which is something that I imagine was difficult for you to do.
Well, I think when I'm reporting, when I'm actually in the moment of reporting, I would describe it as saying I'm my best self, in the sense that I'm, my judgmental faculties are sort of shut down in a way. I'm really focusing on just trying to get down what's happening. So what I was doing here is I was really just trying to pay attention to, you know, one woman and, you know, four children and all these different orders. And actually at the time, parts of it were quite comical to me because the kids kept changing what they wanted and she was going crazy. And I was trying to just get the details down. It's really much later when I actually sit down to write that the feelings that I sort of disconnect from at those moments resurface.
Now, just to sort of backtrack here, Coco's initial companion is a fellow by the name of Caesar.
Yes.
Who goes to jail for shooting his best friend accidentally.
Yes. It's her first love, with whom she has two children.
Mercedes
and
Nautica,
and Nautica,
who are both here.
Yes.
Kodak is another companion of Coco's. That's Nikki's father.
Yes.
Wishman is another companion. That's Pearl's father. And then Frankie, the fellow who's mentioned here, is Lamonte's father.
Yes.
And when you're tracking that switching around of partners and beds and prisons, how is it that you are able to just tell what happens with those judgmental faculties shut down that you're talking about?
Well, I think the length of time I spent reporting the book allowed me to be more sensitive to seeing things in proportion to the perspective from which I was trying to get their perspective, really. I think had I written the book 2 or 3 years into it, I would have made more of certain things that were quite striking to me at the beginning. But much later in the process, I was sort of dulled by the repetition of certain events. They became familiar. They ceased to surprise me. They sort of just sort of emerged in their rightful proportion, really, is how I would describe it again. And I think it was just the length of time, so I was able to relate to things that had initially surprised me. For example, I remember when I first started reporting, people would talk about imprisonment very casually, which I couldn't really understand until I had been there for quite a while and saw how frequent it was.
We'll talk more about prison because it plays a large part in the book Random Family, almost like another character, another member at the table. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about a remarkable 11-year reporting stint in the Bronx. Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc is my guest, and we invite you to call us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. Random Family is the name of a new book by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, which takes you through the strange and often very sad stories of boys and girls and the children that they have and the mothers and the fathers that they have and the way that they try to survive. And you keep going back to prison and telling this story. You can't avoid it.
One of the moments that was initially striking to me was when I first started hanging around the neighborhood and we would go to visit Caesar in prison and Coco would return to the block. We would often run into people that we had seen in the lines, at the prisons, or there would be casual references to the units in prisons, not even the name of the prison itself. So instead of saying, you know, is he at Rikers Island, or how's he doing, is he at Rikers, people would say, is he on GRC, or is he in this unit, that it was such a deeply assumed part of the fabric of life that there was a language to it, you know, a sort of there were short references to it, and those were signals to me that prison occupied something quite differently in this world than it would certainly in mine.
The people themselves, the people that you write about, don't necessarily make judgments about people who go to prison or people who take drugs or all the things that most of us are raised to think are bad things.
Well, I don't know if it's that. I think it's the judgments are less useful in this context than other kinds of coping mechanisms, because the challenge really is not when one surrenders to those pressures, but more of people trying to support each other in the fight not to surrender to those things, so that when somebody does fall, which is a term that people use when they fall to trouble or they fall prey to drugs, people feel a sadness that I think is, it's not that people don't have but judgment is just sort of a useless measure in a way. It's more that you would want to avoid someone's mom who's using because you don't want to shame her. So you wouldn't want to see her on the street. You would turn, you know, Coco would avert her eyes as a gesture of respect for the anguish that person was going through. It wasn't that Coco, but I would say judgment was probably not the primary response. I think that the judgment tended to enter into the issue when folks moved out of this world into other worlds. So when perhaps we would go to social services and there was a sort of connection to other parts of the wider world where that judgment actively came into play. People would become defensive. They might become, sensitive to the judgment. But I think there was so much else going on in the actual community that the judgment wasn't afloat quite in the way it might be in the middle-class world looking into that world.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Newton, Massachusetts now, and Deirdre's joining us. Hi, Deirdre.
Hi. I just have some thoughts from Ms. LeBlanc. I'm a social worker, and I have been in the trenches of social work in the state of Massachusetts with the juvenile justice system. I've seen bunches and bunches of horrible and really sad children situations, been to court many times, filed 51As, protective services reports on these children. And just, I'm wondering about the utility of your book, and I'm, of course, hopeful that somebody important will read it and think about it and sort of send funding where it needs to be gone.
What are you saying, though, Deirdre, that you don't think that will happen?
I can't imagine it. I mean, it's sounding almost like a voyeuristic effort to me, and I'd like to hear that it isn't.
What do you mean voyeuristic?
Well, you're looking in from the outside. I mean, when you go in and you really try to make a difference, for example, as people in social services do, your modus operandi is to make things better.
To change them.
Mm.
But isn't part of that knowing what is there in the first place?
Absolutely.
I just wonder whether or not your own experience, knowing what you do of that life and the people who live it, gives you some kind of a privileged perspective here that those of us who don't work in it don't have.
I have to imagine that that's true.
May I say one thing that I feel is I think that anything that contributes to a sense of the humanity of people in poverty is an active contribution to the social justice issue. But I also feel there's been a terrific burden on poor people in media and in literature to be far more rational and well thought out and well behaved than other people. And I think anything that allows people in poverty to be as conflicted, as baffling, as joyful as, you know, whatever the rest of us get to be, can sort of enhance the kinds of conversations we have about how to aid people in need. So I don't think voyeuristic is something I would describe, you know, use to describe the depth of detail. I certainly hope not.
Deirdre, thanks for your call. I want to go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Nez is on the line. Hi, Nez.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to say thank you for writing a book. I hope, like the other caller says, somebody hears what goes on there and makes a difference. I grew up in the projects, and I grew up in that environment. And as now that I moved out, I've been able to see something different, been able to get an education that I wasn't able to get. And it's different. So I just, it's nice to see that someone has seen it and wrote a book, and maybe somebody maybe pick it up and make a difference for some of the kids in there.
When you're talking to people in Raleigh, Nez, mm-hmm. do you find that the people there have any idea about the kind of life that you lived before you left the projects?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anybody, I mean, you go into the schools here, and the schools are totally different. I mean, you've got pictures on the walls, you've got lights for Christmas, you've got books that you get to take home. I played cards and dice in high school, and I never learned anything other than that. And I don't think they looked at us as if we were going to be anything more than what we are today. And I'm a firefighter as I speak today. I'm going to school. I go to the community college. And things that I would have never thought I would have been able to grab when I lived up north in New York, I'm doing it here. I own a brand-new car, a house. And when I lived in a project, I stood there and I said I'd live in a project and I would die in a project. And that would be all I had. But being able to step out of that and see something different, which was a miracle for me, and just a gift that they gave me.
Congratulations to you.
Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you to the lady who wrote the book, and hopefully somebody read it and maybe help those kids out in the inner city.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the support.
I suspect that people will and pay attention like that. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, the book, Random Family. I'm wondering if, because it's come up a couple of times, a sort of clashing of two worlds, whether or not it would be useful to go to that scene in the book where Coco picks the kids up from summer camp, because that's almost a moment where they're out of the life that they're forced to lead.
Is perhaps the only moment in the book, actually, where they move out of that world. I mean, there are trips to prison, and there are trips to various agencies, but this is a moment where the children attend a camp for kids at risk. It's a therapeutic camp. There's a 1-to-1 counselor camper ratio, and the children have gone there and had a fantastic couple of weeks, and Coco and I arrived to collect them and bring them home.
Here you go.
Okay. And Mercedes is the eldest child. Mercedes spotted her mother immediately. She ran to Coco and flung her arms around her. Coco cried. Her daughter's fresh face was ebullient. The circles were gone from beneath her eyes. She smiled broadly. Nikki approached Coco tentatively. Sniffling, Coco hugged them both with one arm. With the other, she burrowed in her bags for their jewelry. Mercedes spoke excitedly about her new friends, but Coco was untangling earrings and necklaces and chains and slipping rings on their small fingers. She presented Mercedes with an ankle bracelet with two special charms, a horseshoe for good luck and a pacifier. Coco pinned Nikki's earlobes with earrings and clipped her necklace. She put her own rings on, too. Mercedes was probably the most popular girl in the camp, said Beth, the head counselor from Mercedes's bunk. Thank you, Coco replied. Who did your hair? She whispered to Nikki. Nikki mumbled, my counselor. For the camp people, it don't look so bad, Coco said reassuringly. Coco busied herself changing Nikki's clothes. She lifted off Nikki's camp Ramapo shirt and held open new yellow shorts for her to step into. Nikki's lack of enthusiasm for the outfit deflated Coco. Mercedes put on the clothes somberly. The sisters stared at one another in consternation. What was going on? Coco straightened Nikki's waistband and centered her gold chain, then leaned back and appraised her redressed daughters. Then she seemed to sense the general shift in mood. She turned to Nikki's counselor and said, but she looks so pretty in jewelry. No one had said a word. Mercedes led her sisters and her mother to the learning center, a space with high ceilings, child-sized tables, and shelves of books. Campers' art covered the walls. Mercedes located her package, a large green garbage bag brimming with 3 weeks' worth of art. She removed a spider that she'd created out of straw. What's that, Mercedes? Your father? Coco laughed. No, a spider, Mercedes said, seeming confused. The learning center teacher introduced herself. She said, one of Mercedes's favorite books is Girls Can Do Anything. I want to be a doctor, Mercedes announced. Coco looked surprised. A flash of worry passed over Mercedes's open face. Coco smiled dumbly at the floor. Mercedes added, "I want to be a mom." Coco went off in search of Nikki. On the ride home, Coco wondered aloud if Mercedes's counselor had lied to her about Mercedes's popularity. It was hard for Coco to imagine the Mercedes she knew as beloved among her peers. Mercedes was a problem child, a fighter. Nikki had always been the likable one. Mercedes' obvious camp success pointed to Coco's failure to care well for Mercedes herself. Mercedes seemed to intuit this and began to revise her camp experience, proclaiming as boring activities that hours earlier she'd loved. She downplayed the importance of her new friends. She denounced her accomplishments, just as her mother had at Thorpe, when she was on the brink of striking out on her own. Mercedes swore she was never going back to the awful camp. Then, like a tittering schoolgirl, she called her counselor Beth, with whom she'd been affectionate, Fatso in Spanish. Coco laughed greedily. "I know I shouldn't," she said, but she did, covering her mouth. Back at Corliss Park, Mercedes could see that her ordinarily tidy room had been occupied. Her teddy bear still hung from the wall beside her Christmas stocking and the poster of Roberto Clemente Frankie had lent her. But the Pocahontas tent that Coco had bought Nikki for her birthday had collapsed, and the furniture that Caesar had made was covered with laundry. Someone had used the window's tracking as an ashtray and left a small burn mark in the metal. A lucky money candle leaned against the rim. That night, Mercedes invited Nikki to join her in the revived Pocahontas tent while downstairs, Coco chucked her daughter's artwork in the garbage. She called it extra mess.
That was a moment for me where, you know, a parent throws out a child's artwork calling it an extra mess, where I thought, well, there's something very powerful going on in that particular moment. Did you sense it as well?
I did. It was one of the few moments in my memory that I was actively angry at Coco. And I thought hard and long about including the scene because I felt that I couldn't get my emotions out of the way for quite a while. And I later realized that part of the reason I was angry is because it was one of the rare moments where we were straddling both, you know, I say this in quotes, my world and her world. And I also didn't know where to put my frustration at the enormity of the task that lay before Coco in encouraging their assimilation into that world, which effectively meant the abandonment of her and the expertise that she had to give them about a world where jewelry did matter more than a camp T-shirt, and artwork was, you know, it was a signal of pleasure that they'd had apart from her. And I could completely relate to that, but in a person-to-person way, I felt, where do we put this frustration? And also, Ramapo Camp has since devised programs to sort of keep active in the children's lives over the year because they found that the transition back home
just too much of a thump
is a thump, and that the work they do needs to be supported throughout the year and to enlist the parents in that process more, you know, to engage them in the actual camp itself.
Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island. Manuk's joining us now on the phone. Hi, Manuk.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
I'm one of those people that have not had the great opportunity your guest has, and we're just, all of us, replete with all the news media of what goes on in these neighborhoods, not knowing that to some great degree that's the exception which we are ruled by in our judgment, and maybe even the children being ruled by as they're probably, you know, moderating their dreams. I was asking, you touched upon this point just recently about what gave you this great pause, and I think that many of us who've had an opportunity to meet children, as I have in the middle schools, who came to a conference and were asked, how many of you want to go on to higher education, just like this little girl wanted to be a doctor, and all these hands went up. They all wanted to go on to college. The next question was, who wants to be a homemaker? And not one hand went up. And suddenly there was an older woman in the room, and she said, I have had 8 children, and none of them are dead, and none of them are jail. And she got an ovation. That was the moment for great pause for me. And I had to learn how heroic that was. And that's what I wanted to bring across.
Well, thank you for your thoughts. One thing that it reminds me of also is that I think the deep connections among the children carry a lot of responsibility in a world with this kind of hardship. It's just a fact of life that a young child has to assist a single mom in all kinds of domestic tasks. And I think some of the issues about one's future that arise in this scene with Mercedes is that it is literally threatening for a mom to lose a child to another world. I mean, in part because they rely on them very heavily as partners in surviving the grind of daily life. So I think a lot of the best programs for young people are trying to find ways to tap into the strengths of children who are far older than their age in some ways and sustain those connections in more constructive ways and yet encourage them to have lives that are filled with more opportunities.
But even in a life where they concentrate as hard as they do on surviving, there's still an understanding and a priority placed on education, which never leaves
absolutely.
The families. I mean, that's something that they all that acknowledge they all, is the way out, right?
Absolutely. And Coco, her entire life is really devoted to trying to get the best things for her children. I mean, she was certainly a very young mother when she started, but what was so painful about that camp moment is I knew exactly how much she wanted the best for her children, and yet at that moment, what a profound struggle it was within her.
Everything that she was trying to offer
do.
Was being questioned or challenged by what the kids had picked up.
And she was trying to, and at the same time, she had said, you know, how do you get a job like this? She was fascinated by the job of being a camp counselor. It looks like so much fun to her. And here she was, a young woman in her 20s. It was an unimaginable job that you could spend the day in this beautiful place.
Talking to other women who were in their young 20s, right?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. 1-800-423-8255. A look in on a world that will take you somewhere that we don't spend a lot of time. Random Family, the books by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. We'll come back after the break and talk further about her work and her research and the characters that she brings to us. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, the latest...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. Her new book, Random Family, chronicles 11 years of reporting that she did on an extended and somewhat rambling random family in the Bronx. And if you're interested in finding out more about the book or places that Adrienne's going to be visiting, there's a link on our website at theconnection.org, and you can find out more there. You put in the title, Adrienne, love. Love, drugs, trouble, and coming of age in the Bronx, and there are times when I think, wow, there's not a lot of love going on there. And was I missing something?
Well, I see love everywhere in this book. People have said that to me, but I was initially really driven by the two love stories of these young women. I mean, it's in retrospect, it's certainly a book about all these issues, homelessness and teenage pregnancy and the drug trade, but I was really driven by the movement toward love that all of these young people had. Now, some went in directions that did not fulfill the needs that they had, but that they did run toward other people in a way that was about the celebration of life, which is where I think the children come into the picture, you know, the early pregnancies. But I see love everywhere in it. Perhaps it was my failure as a writer that it didn't all get in there.
No, I think that it's in... It's in interpretation because the children don't all appear as accidents, as annoying interferences with an adult life, the way that they would in a middle-class family with a 14-year-old daughter who gets pregnant. Is that a difference that
is accurate? I think it is. I certainly know that children are, you know, they come along for the ride of life. You know, the thing that I found quite enjoyable in the reporting time is that children are part of life. They're sort of, and I guess there's a downside to this certainly, but I know in the lives of some of my friends from other parts of the world that children sort of occupy a certain space that's quite, there are parameters, there are rules, they're allowed into the conversation at certain moments or not. Children in this world are around all the time. There are communities where children are visible at all times. They're outside in the sidewalks. I live in a neighborhood in New York where you rarely see children. It was a world of life in that way. So,
can you think of a time in that 11 years when you actually personally looked forward to leaving your world to go to their world, either because you wanted to catch up or because there was a certain energy?
Almost immediately, I felt that way all the time. Huh. I ceased to be able to sustain interest in my life. It really was the driving force of energy in my life. It was where I wanted to be.
For birthdays, for events.
For holidays. I missed lots of sort of events in my own blood family, weddings. I missed christenings. I missed many things to be where I was. And I was deeply content. And part of the reason the book finally was finished was my dad became ill and my heart sort of drifted toward him. And I could not be present in the full sense that I had been, which was a sort of signal to me that my time was done in terms of the reporting. It was time to really write up. But I was fully engaged for the majority of the field work, fully, fully engaged.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina now, and Dally's joining us. Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I lived in the Bronx and worked in Uptown Manhattan in Harlem. And I think it's a very interesting book. I'd just like to know if the writer sensed any sense, any sense of resilience in these children.
Resilience. Your question is whether or not there was a sense of resilience in
yes.
the children? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, I absolutely think so. If by resilience you mean an ability to sort of get back up and get at it. But yes. I do feel that part of the value of having watched people over time is that I think also running alongside that is that damaging circumstances do damage. And the damage takes a toll that is ongoing with children and not visible until later in life, perhaps. But I think, in fact, the danger of focusing on the resilience is I think that it sort of in some way keeps the bad parts of their lives in the forefront. And in fact, what I found to be the most useful way to look at it is the absence of constructive good things. So what's remarkable to me is how long they sort of persist in functioning with the utter absence of constructive activities in their lives. And then at a certain point, often around their early teens, they just inevitably fall prey to the negative forces around them. But the fact that they're able to sustain that resistance for so many years in the absence of other things, I think is remarkable. But that absence is the part I would focus on as opposed to their stamina.
What's your own experience, Dally?
My experience over there actually has been, I'm a child psychiatrist. And what we have tended to do up in the Bronx is to try as much as possible to play on the sense of resilience of the kids and build it up, fortify it. And we get good results based on that.
Yes, I know Mercedes, the one of the children in this book, she had a teacher that was particularly sensitive to her strengths as a leader in her family. She understood that she had a lot of parenting responsibility. And instead of trying to break her of her confidence in that way as a young adult, she gave her more responsibility in the classroom and found that to be very effective.
And she takes off. She becomes almost a leader. I mean, a real sort of character.
She blossoms.
Yeah, under that teacher. Dally, thanks a lot for your call. To Boston now, and Manuel's joining us. Hi, Manuel.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would respectfully submit to the lady on your show that, I grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in Simpson Street, and I remember as a five-year-old boy, my mother waking me up off the couch because I didn't have a bed because my building was on fire, and we had to go downstairs. And it was a cold day. I was huddled downstairs on the sidewalk with all my fellow neighbors and my sister and my single mother with a bed sheet wrapped around us as this building, which had been torched on purpose, went up to in smoke, and one fire truck showed up. And my life in New York City, particularly in the Bronx and in Queens where I grew up as a boy, was not, frankly, as romantic as I'm hearing it described. My neighbors did not seem to fit the character portrayal that I'm hearing on your show. I didn't find anything romantic about living in the ghetto.
I actually don't. You know, if I've given you the impression from having read the book that it somehow romanticizes the ghetto, I recommend you pick yourself up a copy and make your own judgment. I don't know whether or not...
I think it's actually quite unsentimental. I mean, it's one of my greatest frustrations. You know, one thing I just absolutely try to avoid at all costs is sentimentality and romanticization. But I would say that, of course, there's beauty in life everywhere. And to not portray that as well is irresponsible as a journalist. But I think if you were to look at the book, you would see it's not a romantic portrayal of life there. But I would say there is a community there. I absolutely feel there's a strong sense of community, and I think that's a good thing.
Sadly, I grew up in the shadow of death, and that still exists today because I still have family in the Bronx. And your optimism about life is fantastic. I appreciate it. I don't think it's grounded in what's really happening in these neighborhoods, at least not in my neighborhood. I work now as a dentist in a town in Rhode Island, all minorities. And I see it there, too. Although I try to be optimistic, being a Spanish man, talking in Spanish daily with my patients, having grown up, going back to see my family, I can tell you that these people do not need words like... I don't know. I just don't see it this way. I did not grow up with the world's greatest optimism. I didn't see it in my neighbors.
These people grow up with cockroaches on their food. I don't think it's very romantic. You have a short paragraph.
Yeah, I just wonder if I could read a brief paragraph that sets the opening scene. Perhaps this would speak to your good question. The Coco's father, stepfather, is basically telling her not to get pregnant as her older sister has just done. And this is the passage that follows. He said, "Guard yourself and aim for a better life." Exactly how she was supposed to do this was unclear, but Coco might have instinctively understood that success was less about climbing than about not falling down. Since there were few real options for mobility, people in Coco's world measured improvement in microscopic increments of better than whatever was worse. These tangible gradations mattered more than the cliched language of success that floated blandly out of everyone's mouth, like fugitive sentiments from a Hallmark card. Girls were going to make something of themselves as soon as the baby was old enough. Boys were going to do right and stay inside. Everyone was going back to school. But better than was the true marker. Thick and fed was better than thin and hungry. Family fights indoors, even if everyone could hear them, were better than taking private business to the street. Heroin was bad, but crack was worse. A girl who had four kids by two boys was better than a girl who had four by three. A boy who dealt drugs and helped his mom and kids was better than a boy who was greedy and spent the income on himself. The same went for girls and their welfare checks. Mothers who went clubbing and didn't yell at their kids the next tired day were better than mothers who did.
All right. Thanks for that. And Manuel, thanks for your call to Brookline, Massachusetts now. And Fran's on the line. Hi, Fran.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say to Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, I just adored the book. I thought it was searing and very compassionate. Huge impression on me. I have two questions. One is, I got very attached to the characters. So anything you can tell us, I want to say, how are they? How is Coco, Mercedes, Serena? And then secondly, maybe a more analytical question. Can you identify anything that you could put into words which answers the question, what helps someone in some ways create a better life? What qualities? And do you see maybe Coco, Mercedes, or Serena moving towards whatever we mean by a better life?
Fran, thanks for your call.
Well, I think the second question can help with the first. I think the basic things always help people, and that the basic things are what are in disrepair in Coco's life. So better housing, better wages, better daycare, schools that have more support all contribute to helping. In Mercedes's case, in the last year, she had, in the last 2 years ago, she finally got a big sister from the Big Brother Big Sister program. This young woman has made an enormous difference in Mercedes's life. Coco works extremely long hours, sometimes 16 hours a day, at an industrial cleaning job. and needs to work long hours and overtime because she's not paid well. And this big sister is a huge relief to Coco to know that her daughter is constructively engaged with a responsible adult while she's working. Serena has had a little boy and is in school trying to get her high school degree. And people are, you know, a lot of people are working. They're working jobs that aren't necessarily so gratifying. And some are, you know, in Coco's case, she works a lot of toxic chemicals. So there are all kinds of issues that will come to bear if she continues in this work.
Tell me if the people that you're describing have read the book and how they feel about the way that they were portrayed.
Well, most of them have read it. And I respond to people by saying that people have sort of responded in character. So Caesar, who's incarcerated, and he and I have a very sort of intellectually connected relationship. We've had lots of debates over the implications of it. He told me he thought I did an amazing job and that it brought back the feelings of his childhood home to him. And he also felt quite hungry for the information about his children growing up. I see his children more than he does. He doesn't know what their houses look like, what their days are like.
And Coco?
She has been reading it in pieces when she can on her job at lunch breaks. The book is sort of passed around amongst her coworkers, and the parts of it she really enjoys. You know, some of it she said to me, I really look like a sucker in the early part, all the things that Caesar put me through. And then she said, but it's true. So she's her very straightforward self.
They like it, though.
I've been really humbled by their response to the book. It means the world to me if they feel that it captures some part of their experience, and I feel really, really pleased that they do.
It's been great to have you here talking about the book.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. The book is called Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9282.